All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Big Questions with Big John. I am your host, Big John. And as always, today we have a very interesting guest, someone that, you know, his name may not be as familiar to you as some of our previous guests, but let me assure you, everyone out there, he is just as interesting or more interesting than a lot of my other guests. So in the tradition of the Big Questions with Big John, let me open with a biographical summary of our guest. You know, in a world where financial markets move faster than ever, one innovator is redefining how traders navigate all the chaos that surrounds them. From a small town in Italy to leading a global fintech revolution, our guest has built a company that empowers everyday investors with cutting-edge tools, all while staying fiercely independent and transparent in an industry often clouded by hype and deception. His unique vision has sparked both admiration and a little bit of debate, but there's no denying his impact on automated trading, especially in the currency markets. This is something up my alley, being a former trader myself. Everyone, please welcome David Materazzi to the Big Questions. David, how are you tonight?
Thanks for having me, John. Wow, that was like an amazing intro. You know, I hope I can meet the expectations, right?
Oh, but, I'm sure you will. Yeah, thank you so much. You're welcome. Yeah. And listen, David is actually joining us from Italy. So, you know, David, Greeks and Italians, una razza, una fata, we're basically the same culture. And I know the time it is in Italy right now is the most important meal of the day. It's right before dinner, probably with family. It's a time when everybody eats together, right? They have a little bit of what happened during your day. So I promise I'm not going to interrupt your dinner. We'll keep this to a timely interview. But speaking of that, I think it is important that people understand the culture that you were brought in, because I truly believe that culture shapes how as our culture as children shapes what we become as adults. So please tell me a little bit about your upbringing in Italy, Arezzo, Italy. I hope I pronounced that right. And what was life growing up?
It was boring. that's the first thing. You know, until I got my first computer, you know, at 9 years old in 96, I think. You know, it was a good life. You know, it's a small town in Italy, so nothing really going on. You know, lots of traditions. That's good. You know, lots of family. You know, you have your Sunday dinner every Sunday with your grandparents and everything. That's, you cannot miss that, right? You go to church every Sunday. But it was, you know, I knew that there was so much more, you know, to life than this. And, you know, my passions basically, I didn't have the environment, right? I didn't live in the environment where I could, you know, grow and like even see or even talk to other people about what I liked. And especially I liked computers. And I liked rock music, right? Rock and roll music. And in my small town, you know, the only things that people really care about was like soccer, sports. You know, they're huge about sports. You know, soccer in particular. You go to play with your friends. You talk about soccer and this match, the other. And I didn't have much interest into that, right? Mm. And going to clubs, you know, on Saturday. So that was like a small, you know, life for me. And I knew there was so much more to life, especially, you know, the first I got the computer, that, you know, when I saw the computer, it made me think, wow, there are people in this world that, you know, they're creating some really cool stuff, right? Somebody has created this, right? Somebody was behind this. And I remember, like, you know, sitting there, like, you see something, like, for the first time. And that was, like, I think, a huge, you know, something really huge in my life. Then I had to move out of the city. So, you know, with the excuse of college, I was, you know, I did my best to get admitted, you know, to the best university for economics in Italy, which is also, you know, in Europe, pretty good, the Bocconi University. I got admitted. But the real reason was I wanted to go, you know, out of this small town.
You just wanted, you wanted to get away from a small town. That's actually very common. Before you continue, let me ask you this. I agree with you. It's fascinating how we have very similar backgrounds, maybe 30 years apart, but very similar. Mm-hmm. I remember in high school, maybe not at 9 years old, but in high school, we got introduced to the first IBM punch card computers. This is how old I am. It was when you still had to fill out those paper cards.
I know that.
You know, and shade everything out. And I remember when I first saw that behemoth and I said, wow. And immediately I was drawn to it. But my first inclination was, how do I use a computer to write games? I remember the first program I ever wrote was a blackjack program. No graphics. Yes. When you saw the computer and you said to yourself, wow, this is something I'm drawn to, what was your first, like, maybe not at nine, but say maybe as you got a little bit older, you had practiced on the computer a little bit. What was your first inclination? Was it, wow, this is for games? Wow, this is for business? Wow, this is for science? How did you start to get attracted to computing? What did it make you think about?
Okay, that's, you know, actually, there is one still working computer, those IBM punch cards, and I've seen that in at the American Museum of Computers in Silicon Valley.
Oh, my God, I'm old.
No, I'm old. Yeah, time flies.
I know, I'm joking.
Yeah. So, but, you know, that they still have one, and it's incredible, like, the progress. And you were mentioning gaming, and actually that's, you know, what, you know, the computers in the beginning, like, the whole history, that's, you know, what was drawing people to computers. Like, it wasn't seen like something serious, or we have to, you know, do education with this thing, or do corporations, or whatever, efficiency and productivity. It wasn't seen like a tool like that. It was more like a discovery, right? Something like a new discovery for humanity, and people weren't taking it too seriously. And same with the internet. So answering your question, I think it really opened. I didn't never see the computer as a gaming, because I wasn't really into too much into video games. I don't know why, but just wasn't. And yeah, I played some video games, but it wasn't my, you know, cup of tea, right, as they say in England. But I think the internet opened, you know, a lot of knowledge at the time, especially, you know, the end of the 90s, early 2000s. Basically, it was the Wild West. The internet was just, you know, the Wild West. It was full anonymous. Yes. It was anonymous. Anybody could write anything. It was like all the laws and regulations were totally behind, like, 20 years what was going on in the internet. So you had all this exchange of files, you know, and people sharing, you know, intellectual property and stuff like that, music and movies and stuff like that. For years, this went on for years and years. You know, that's before even e-commerce came, you know, before big businesses started to, you know, use the internet and computers just to make money, basically, right? So I was into more like knowledge. I used the internet really to expand my, to learn. And even pictures at the time, you know, they were like, you know, very heavy files. They were heavy files, like 1 megabyte at the time. It took like 10 minutes to download, right? So I was basically reading. And that's how also I learned English, because in Italian, we had some materials in Italian, but, you know, the stuff I was interested in, we didn't have. We didn't have it in Italian, right? So, you know, basically I was, that's how it was born, my interest. That's how I saw it. Like, it's a tool to grow and to make yourself better and to, you know, learn about things that otherwise I would never have learned, you know, those things.
Right.
Right. And of course, as a business, you know, business opportunity, I always liked business and selling things. And, you know, I was going to these flea markets when I was really young and donating all the money at the end of the day and selling, you know, stuff that you don't need anymore. But I just like the fact of, you know, dealing with customers and, you know, maybe negotiating a price.
That's what's interesting to me, because, you know, when I was reading over your biography a little bit and looking into how you came along, you went to the university, you wanted to study economics, and you were first drawn to marketing, right? You were first drawn to sales and marketing. Now, did that come – talk to me about this. Did that come out of your outgrowth of learning about markets from an economics point of view, and you said – or – was it more that you have an outgoing personality? I mean, we talked for 5 minutes before the cameras went on. We had a great conversation. I think we had a 2-hour conversation in 5 minutes, right? You seem to be very outgoing. You have a very outgoing personality. And, you know, if you take any of those personality tests, your personality fits very much in line with marketers, salespeople. Whereas, you know, if I took that Myers-Briggs test, I always come up somewhere in the middle, right? Somewhere stuck between an introverted nerd and somewhere between an extroverted salesman, right? So I'm somewhere in the middle. I get the impression, based on your personality, that you're more outgoing. Is that something that led you directly, you think, to sales, at least initially, and marketing initially? Or was it just that you enjoyed
people? Subconsciously, yes. Subconsciously, probably, yes. I never thought about it in that way, but probably, yes, because I was always outgoing. But at the same time, I always like to think with my own mind. You know, when I heard people just repeating what other people were saying, I was just, you know, I still don't respect that, right? Just like the sheep, right. You know, blah, blah, blah. And I don't like that, right? I never respected that. So I was lucky enough to be arrogant enough as well, not just outgoing and friendly, but arrogant enough to do things my own way and think my own way, right? Even going against the crowd a lot of times at the university and everything, right? And for me, I took many decisions that were totally, you know, against, you know, the things that were other people were doing. But right now, if you look after 10, 15 years, I was right, they were wrong, right? Mm. We can measure it in many, many ways. We can measure it financially. We can measure it by happiness, by whatever you want to measure it. But I'm, you know, I feel blessed. And my the big reason was because I was strong enough mentally to do what I thought was right, not to do what, you know, the professors were saying, my parents were telling me, or other people, my friends were telling me, right? Not to go the safe path. I always wanted to go to, you know, something, you know, unexplored territory, like a jungle in a sense, right? I feel like, right. You know, when you win, then it's, you have double the satisfaction, right? And, you know, I don't want remorses in life. You know, that's also one of the reasons why much later, many, many, many years later, I resigned from, you know, a position at an investment fund to start my own business, because I didn't want remorse, right? I didn't want to live with this remorse that, oh, I could have done it, oh, but, you know, and my parents would say, are you crazy, right? Are you crazy? You have this amazing job. Why would you?
Right.
They see risks everywhere. I don't see the risk. And maybe, you know, I'm right many times. It's, most of the time, I think it's calculating risks. Even at young age, like, should I do like a master's degree or should I go to work and learn? I did the second. I think the only one in my class to do that, like to just go straight to work instead of, you know, I said, maybe these 2 years is much better if I work and I build skills and I learn how to do things instead of studying, you know, another bunch of books and theory, right?
Now it's interesting that you said these things. I noticed that you used the word arrogance instead of confidence. So yeah. I just want to make sure, I mean, your English is perfect, but I just wanted to make sure. When you say
arrogance. In a sense, it's arrogance, because I didn't really know. If I was, you know, confidence, I think it's when you feel like, yes, this is, you know, logically, rational, right?
Right.
But here, it wasn't rational. So, and when it was arrogance, but you can have good arrogance and bad arrogance, right? It depends on your values and your principles and how you direct. You know, people tend to think arrogance as, you know, like a negative word. The way I mean it was like arrogance against, you know, the dogma, like the way, the decisions I took, right? That in a sense, I was, you know, making big decision. I moved to Canada, right? Just after, without any job, with a visa of 6 months. I resigned, right? I took some decisions that were questionable. You know, if that's the, you know, I think the arrogance. Confidence, it's another part. Of course I was confident. You know, the moment I resigned, I knew that I could do this, right? When I went to Canada, I knew that I could go, you know, and find a job and, you know, just get a good agreement, good job, a good contract. I knew that I could do it. So the arrogance, I think it comes in this case from the sense of, you know, from just going against, you know, the dogmas and what is usually, you know, what people think you should do to succeed and what actually you should do to succeed.
Right. And that's a great question because you just said a lot. It's fascinating. And I want to dig into it a little bit. So you land in Toronto, you went to Canada, which in and of itself, for someone who has spent his whole life in a particular country, you know, it's much like the typical immigrant experience, right?
I was an immigrant.
Unlike today's fervor here in the United States, I am not anti-immigration. I am pro-immigration, especially when it comes to the steps that a lot of immigrants took. I think of my parents. I think of yourself coming to my parents came to the United States. You went to Canada. You're going to a country that doesn't speak your language. You have to speak your second language there. The systems are different. Yes, you might have had some exposure, but you basically going to somewhere where you don't have family support. So I appreciate the courage that takes But when you get to Toronto, you as you said, you got a job in the financial sector. But again, at this point, is it still sales and marketing, or are you actually starting to trade? No, sales and marketing.
More than sales and marketing, I always liked business, okay? I really liked business strategy. I was studying Michael Porter, right? All these people from Harvard Business School. I was reading Harvard Business Review. So I was more into the business side, but, you know, the operations or accounting wasn't really fun and creative, right? Marketing, at least. You know, it can be more. You can be more creative in general, and I'm just not talking about the colors and the fonts. You know, that's like a very narrow view of marketing. Right. Marketing, you know, is actually about what price are we going to charge? You know, what positioning are we going to have in the marketplace for this product? What is
How do we segment our audiences? Who do we target?
Exactly.
Where's our next dollar best spent? You know, like you're talking about
exactly.
Not what people perceive as marketing from television and movies.
Yeah.
You're talking about the science of marketing.
The real
marketing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
The real marketing.
The real stuff, right? The real stuff, the professional marketing, not the influencer or like the small business doing these TikTok videos, right? That's like a very, you know, basic form of marketing. You can do it well. You can succeed with it. But, you know, I'm talking more like marketing. It works together with products. Right?
Right.
You make decisions about the products. What name are we going to use for this product? Right? What price are we going to charge for the product? What, you know, packaging are we going to use for and why? Right? So there is a lot of thinking about society, about people, about psychology, about, you know, crowds and groups of people and culture. If you sell something in the US, it's not the same, you know, as selling it in Japan. Right?
Right.
And it's still, you're talking about first world countries. You could make it even harder selling something in Canada and selling something in Somalia, right? So it changes the culture. It's a big part also of marketing. So it's a much more complex, but that's the way I started because I don't know. I just liked it. I always liked, you know, the promotional side in a sense, but seriously, okay? Not just, you know, let's have some fun and design a campaign. That's not, I wouldn't regard that as marketing, okay? So the real science, and there are books, even Scientific Advertising, it's an amazing book from 100 years ago where they explain all this. You know, they used to do it on Park Avenue in New York. I think that was in Park Avenue. They had all these advertising agencies. They filmed the Mad Men, you know, the TV show.
Madison Avenue. Not Park Avenue.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah,
close enough. You know, we can.
It's one avenue apart. We'll let you
fly. Exactly, guys. So that was what fascinated me. Like, we use creativity, but we measure things, right? We measure how we're doing, right? We're getting feedback with numbers, right? You can actually measure anything that you do in marketing with numbers.
Now we can do it from a business perspective. Right.
Yeah, now you can do it with analytics. Yes.
Analytics, right? But back then it was taking polls, research, qualitative research, quantitative research. So it sounds to me like you had your creative side. Certainly, I could tell you're a creative person and your later accomplishments bear that out. But at the same time, you retained, I almost want to call it an academic approach to your efforts, right? Because you weren't, like you said, I want to be creative. I want to design things and make them look pretty. And
I was not an artist.
Yeah,
more like a scientist than an artist. Right. Right? More like a scientific approach.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me, which, again, is old school, believe it or not. It's old school. It's more what I'm familiar with. Being a Gen Xer, it's more what I'm familiar with, trying to blend creativity and science and academia to what it's morphed to today. Without making a judgment, today it seems to be less science and more influence, right? Like you said, it seems to be more influence, attention grabbing, which has its purpose, as opposed to, hey, how many segments are we dividing? Are we doing a cluster analysis to figure out how many different target audience groups we're going to look at? How price points, profit margins, things like that, which seem to be secondary today as opposed to primary the way it was, right? So I fully understand that, and that's an interesting sort of melting pot that you put together for yourself. So you initially started at a financial services company in Toronto. Around 2020, you got the entrepreneurial itch, it sounds like, right? Tell me a little bit about that.
Like in 2020 when I started a company?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been working, you know, in 2020, I had been working for 8 years for this investment fund in Canada. Actually, I had moved back to Italy because I had, you know, the Canadian government sent me a nice letter that, you know, your visa is expiring, you have to go back. And I said, I don't want to say bad words. I said, the money I paid to these, you know, immigration lawyers. And, you know, I had my friends basically doing very regular jobs and working, you know, late nights in a pizzeria. They all got visas. I got an amazing job with a great company. And I had,
a degree. How crazy is that? What was the reason for that?
You want the cynic? You want the truth? Or you want, you know, the truth is the Canadian government wanted, I don't know if they still want because I don't go there anymore. Yeah. But they wanted to give those jobs, the good jobs to Canadians and the bad jobs, you know, to the immigrants. That's
instead of having a high value citizen that wants to
stay. I could be paying millions
there,
in taxes now in Canada.
Right.
Instead I pay them in Italy.
How short-sighted.
With my company, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy. So I said, okay, enough is enough. You know, I'm not like desperate. I'm not, you know, coming from a war zone. I have a dignity in life. I have respect for myself. I did whatever I could. I found a great job. I did all the legal process. I paid these thousands of dollars with the best immigration lawyers. And that you guys send me this letter, you know, that's, I take it personally, you know, in a sense. And, you know, bye-bye. Okay, that's it. And I just said, okay, I'm going to come back home. And thank God I was able to, you know, negotiate an agreement with the company because we were working really well together. I was making a lot of results. I was doing pretty well. So they didn't want to lose me probably. So we negotiated, okay, you're going to start a small office in Italy. We can make it work. Blah, blah, blah. This was way before, you know, remote jobs and COVID and all
right,
this.
Right.
So I was able to, you know, another 4 or 5 years, keep working with the company from Italy. And I had my own small office with people and everything. But it came a certain time where, you know, you have to make a decision. You are 30. I always wanted to start my own business. The reason why I went, you know, looking for jobs is because I couldn't succeed. I started so many, you know, ideas and businesses when I was in my early 20s. All kinds of internet businesses. Nothing worked. So I said, wow, I still have to learn a lot. You know, I became humble. That humbled me. You know, that arrogance we're talking about.
Yeah,
I got humbled pretty quickly, right? Because when you believe, then, you know, oh, I can do this. Yeah, I'm going to succeed, but I don't need to go to work. And then nothing works, right? And I needed to find a job to pay rent and to pay for food. Like, you know, Canada is expensive. Toronto is a really expensive city. It's like New York or LA or San Francisco, right? So my savings were really small, you know. And that was the reason. It was like a necessity, right?
Sure.
So I had skills at the time and I thank God I had these skills in SEO and technical marketing that I didn't learn in university. I learned it on the internet, right? You couldn't even buy books. You walked into a library, you didn't find this stuff like SEO and, you know, optimization and this the Google algorithm, how it works, how we can rank. But the value was there for companies because companies, they wanted to rank, you know, on the first page for the keywords. So they, if we rank first on the first page, we're going to get a lot of clients, a lot of traffic. So it's worth a lot of money. So I had skills that on the market in Toronto, they were really appreciated. So I got like 3-4 different offers from a video game company, from an energy company, from an advertising company. And these were pretty, you know, established company. And then I got this offer from the technology company, trading technology company. And the only reason why I picked that is because when I went to the website, I said, what the hell is this? You know, I never heard about this. And I have a degree in economics and I never even, so just, I was always fascinated by enigmas, by things that are really hard to solve and figure out. And that attracted me way more than energy, you know, we had solar panels, whatever. For me, I mean, with all respect, but for me, it's a little boring, right? I want more excitement every day at work. And that's why the markets, you know, they give you unlimited excitement. And I chose, the financial markets. So, yeah, so that's how I started. They just needed somebody in marketing with my skills. So I had skills that I built outside of the university, right? That's how I got in. The industry. Otherwise, you know, just with a degree and with my grades, you know, I had terrible grades. I think I had the worst grades in my class. But right now, financially, I'm doing better than anybody in the class after 15 years. So what does it tell you? Like that, you know, following the easy path that you just study and you graduate and you find a good job that pays you well, gives you vacation days and sick days, you're never going to become rich, okay? You're never going to become like really, you know, a wealthy person and be free. You can make a lot of money, but are you free? No. So that's what I didn't like about the corporate life. I wasn't free. Right. Yes, they gave me a lot of freedom, because they understood that I was that kind of person who wanted you know, freedom. But at least, you know, even after 8 years, I said, enough is enough. You know, I just, you know, that's it. I'm going to start my own business. That's it. And I just resigned and I started my own business. Very simple, right? You know, it took me some time to think about everything. It wasn't, I'm not an impulsive person, so I never take decisions like impulsively, right? I consider it like instinctively, right? I consider it like a weakness most of the time in people. And we see that in the markets all the time, right? I never heard about like a successful investor or trader using his gut, you know, to decide like what I, you know, that's so. I always think and, you know, as objectively as I can, you know, I could be wrong. You know, what if I make a mistake? But, you know, after a while, you see the situation, like what it really is. And then you analyze it really, really carefully. And you don't see those that many risks. Because I know, you know, if my business failed, yeah, I can just go back and, you know, find another job, right? So what's really the risk? You know, I'm not going to war, right? I'm not going to Vietnam, right? I'm not being shipped to Iraq. So that would be, you know, a big risk, you know, because, you know, 1 out of 3, 1 out of 10, whatever, they get killed. But here, you know, what's the real risk? And other, you know, companies that hire you, that hire me, they can also fail. You know, they can have problems. You know, any company can fail.
Right.
So it's not that, you know, my parents, when they were saying, oh, but what if it doesn't work, you know, and you fail? And yeah, what if the company I'm working for, it fails, right? They could fail as well. So they're still operating in the same in the market, right? Not the same market, but, you know, in the marketplace.
Right, right.
That's how it works. It's a survival instinct, unless you have very good friends in Washington, right? But that's very few people. people. But you get the idea, right?
Yeah, and what you took, so when I was still working on Wall Street, thousands of years ago, the company, the particular trading firm I worked with, had a very, very wise saying, and they said, if you study it properly, risk is your friend. Exactly. Risk is not something to be afraid of, right? But you have to know what the risk is, understand the risk, and then understand how to work the risk, right? So that was all about risk back in those days. And understanding risk, and that's where you made your real money. If you understood risk and was able to manage it. So when you say something like, I took a risk, but I'm not an impulsive person, that is the perfect sort of sweet spot, because you take calculated risks.
Exactly. Calculated risk. That's how we call it. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. To your point, I started a company. You started a company. And if, your mom and your dad say, David, what happens if this fails? You're like, okay, I still know what I know. I still have my knowledge. I can go work for another company. I could start a different company. So that's confidence. That's a calculated risk. It's different from I'm leaving my job. I have no idea what I'm going to do.
Exactly. I would never do that.
I hate working. Right. You took a calculated risk. And I think that's important, because a lot of today's entrepreneurs, the successful ones, always make it sound very easy. They make it sound very glamorous. I said to myself, I'm going to stop working for the man. And I said,
That's
fake
confidence.
Yes.
That's emotional. That's emotional. That's not rational. They think it's about the mindset and the grinding. Yeah, of course. I work until 2 a.m. most of the days during the week, right? I work 16 hours a day. But that's like the basics, right? And you have to do it for many, many years. Every day, right? That enthusiasm that they preach, you know, it doesn't last. After, you know, the first obstacle they hit, boom, they're gone, right? So you have to do it for a long time, and you have to be like, you have to take it really seriously, right? You can't manage a business these days and be all about buzzwords and enthusiasm and the mindset and blah, 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 and conviction. That's fake. confidence, a fake. And risk is about, it's basically everything. Even if you study like the best investors, what they did, like they didn't find ways to make a lot of money. Most of the time they found ways not to lose a lot of money and make, right. you know, like safer money, right? Manage risk and minimize risk as much as possible so that, you know, you have whatever is left is basically free money. That's the other way of looking at things, right? Looking at the right. same things. But most people, they get into investing and trading, thinking about, you know, these huge gains they can make. And yeah, you can have huge gains, you can have huge losses as well, right? So what about limiting losses and then, you know, letting the winning trades and investments go? And then you don't, you know, that's how you really do it. So managing, you know, losses and risk, I think it's the number one skill if you want to, you know, any success in trading. And I see trading and Wall Street and the markets as a metaphor for life. Yes. And in life is the same, right? If you take a stupid risk, uncalculated risk, you can die. I mean, it's very simple, right? If I start driving a Ferrari and I don't know how to drive, I don't have a driving license, and I jump into a Ferrari and I push it, you know, I'm gonna crash into a wall. It's gonna right. end, you know, into a big fire, right? So you can't take risks like that. But at the same time, you can't be afraid of everything, right? You can take risks sometimes. It doesn't work, but you know,
right.
it's worth it, because if it doesn't work, you learn and you don't repeat it. And maybe you try a different approach. And as long as you don't give up and you learn from your mistakes, I know it sounds like a little bit, you know, but that's how I do it, right? That's how I approach things, and it works. And that's your experience compounds, right? And then your knowledge compounds as well. So it grows exponentially instead of growing linearly, right? And you fail faster, but you learn like something really important that's going to get you closer to your goal. So risk, basically, people are afraid of risk because, you know, parents and schools, and also schools, they unfortunately sometimes damage people. They make them feel not confident of themselves, right? Why? Because in school you get the answers first, then you get the questions. So people memorize all these answers, and then they have the question, and they don't want to make mistakes. And if they make a mistake, you get punished. You get a bad grade. Life is not like that. Life, first you have the questions, the answers. You need to find the answers. And
right.
when you're an entrepreneur, right. when you have like, when you don't have all the information, when you don't know the variables in something, you don't have the answers. So you have to figure out a way to manage, you know, what you don't know. So that's also a risk. What you don't know, it's a huge risk. You know, most people, they are overconfident, you know, what they know, they think, you know, the Dunning-Kruger effect, that, you know, people with the lowest amount of knowledge in a certain topic, they are the most confident about that topic. So the more you know about a topic, the more you know about something, the less confident you feel about it. I know it sounds paradoxical, but that's how it is. So, you know, that's a risk. That's a huge risk, especially in investing when you have real money, or like jumping off a cliff or whatever. You know, if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to pay for it, because, you know, risk is mathematics, like how insurances, they understand risk really well.
Right,
that's how they
right.
make, you know, that's how they keep going. So risk can be managed. If a hurricane can be insured, and we can calculate also the, you know, risk for a hurricane, we can calculate lots of risks in life, even without all the information. So people are afraid of making mistakes, of taking risks, and sometimes it looks like, oh my God, what if it goes wrong? But they don't really think it through. It's more like an emotional reaction, right? Like survival instinct, or schools. Could be the schools. I'm pretty sure it's the schools.
Yeah, it's a lot of times it is schools. It is, like you said, it could be your culture, your parents. My parents are very conservative. I find people of that generation who lived through World War II, for example, you know, they lost everything. They were starving. So their perspective in life is, if I have bread to eat tonight and there's a way for me to get bread every night, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to change.
And we live in peaceful times. Because remember, my grandparents, they lived through the World War. We had Nazi occupation here where I was
living.
The Nazis, they killed. We had massacres of civilians and children.
Yes. Yes.
Like out of nothing, with for no reason, because somebody offended like some officer, Nazi officer, so they killed like 10 people. You know, so these, my grandparents, they lived through that. My other grandparents, they escaped communism from, you know, Istria, who became Yugoslavia, you know, and Tito was like the communist dictator. He was killing Italians. Yeah. He was killing Italians just because they were Italians, right? Not even because of their political, just because of like straight out, you know, killing just because of ethnicity.
Yeah, exactly.
So they escaped that. So this was my background, right? I don't come, I don't feel bad by saying that I don't come from, you know, I was the first person to graduate in my family. If you want to know, right? I was the first person to graduate, to have a college degree in my family. So my family was humble and simple. And for them, you know, having a house and a family and a job, this was the best. They were going to vacation once a year, you know, but it seemed very simple.
That was the good life.
They were so happy. They were so happy,
good life.
I can't believe.
Yeah, that was the good life.
They lived through their 90s. They lived through their 90s, 95. They were so happy. They were happy people. Yeah. They were balanced people, right? So that's where I come from. And, you know, but at the same time, for me, that's also a little boring because we had a lot of innovation after, you know, their generation. Right. We saw all this, you know, technology coming. You know, they didn't live through this, you know, personal computer era and this technology, the smartphone. So this opened so many more opportunities that how can I say, you know, no to this? Right? So it's too attractive.
Right. And in hearing you speak, I said, you know, I think I mentioned to you before we started the show, I said, I see a lot of similarities in the way I grew up, maybe not as successful as you, but in terms of how we approach things. And to this day, I'll always say, you know, if I take on an employee or if I mentor a younger person, I'm less interested in how much they know than I am interested in how they think, right? Exactly. I want to see how they think. I want to see enthusiasm. I want to see the ability to stop, consider possibilities. Yes, consider out of the box, but don't be too crazy when we know things aren't going to work. Have we tried this in the past? There's a reason why we don't do certain things, right? We don't have to keep learning the same thing over and over again. We want to build on the things we've learned. And believe it or not, David, I don't know if you – tell me, do you find that quality, the ability to think – like if I were to walk into your offices, and I think you have offices in 4 or 5 locations, right? what's it? Galileo FX, right? FX folks, not special effects, foreign exchange FX, currency markets. Is that something when you look at people to bring into your company, is that your primary thing you look for? Like I want to see how these people think, or do you look for – this guy knows how to code in the latest languages and blah, blah, blah. What do you look for when you bring people on to your company now?
Well, I learned, you know, I started interviewing when I was at the investment fund in Toronto very early, like 25, 26. I was already doing interviews because we had to hire people in the marketing, you know, team. So I had to do these interviews by myself. And I learned, you know, they taught me one thing, always hire for attitude, right? Mm. We don't care if you are competent, attitude. So how is this guy, this person even carrying himself? Is he showing up late? How is his attitude, right? Is he taking, you know, it's too friendly or too secret, too secretive? You know, some people, they're secretive, they're skeptical, they come sometimes, you know. You have all kinds of people, you know, showing up. When you do interviews, you see all kinds of, you know, people, sometimes even, you know, people, you say, oh my God. But depends on the roles. In general, I have a rule in my company that, you know, from the first hire, I wanted people who grow, right, and who get better. So even if they start and they're really good at what they're doing, let's say we bring in like a senior support technician or whatever, even if they're really good on the first day because of their past experience or whatever, I tell them, you know, you start from here. In 2 years, I want to see you here. Because if I'm the only one, and we have like 20, 30 people, if I'm the only one growing, the company is not going to grow. I want everybody to grow. Everybody has to grow. And by growing, what do I mean? Like learning and how can I do this even better? Like I'm not happy with 8 out of 10. I want 10 out of 10 in everything, right? We set really high standards And for the right type of person, this is like, you know, a great environment. It's not like, oh my God, oh, these guys, you know, they want too much from me. They put me too right. pressure, too much pressure on me. That guy, I don't want him. I don't want this kind of person, right? And if I sense that they get too easy on the job after, you know, 3 months, 6 months, you know, I have a very, you know, good discussion, you know, not, of course, you know, normal, like civil, but I'm very direct, right? I'm going to tell them, this is what we agreed. This is what you're doing, right? So I look for people with the right attitude and competence, but most of all, I look at the eyes of people when we talk about their field. If I see that they really like it, you're going to tell, right? If somebody, like, if I'm interviewing for, I don't know, IT project manager or senior software developer, you start talking about something, maybe small talk, then you start mentioning something about their job or some problem or some news or something. You're going to see immediately this person, you know, is it doing this job because, you know, it's just a job? Is he applying just because it's just a job or because he really loves it? Because if you love it, you can grow and you can succeed at it. I want to hire successful people, right? But if to succeed, you have to love it. If you don't love it, you cannot succeed. It's very simple, right? How can you keep doing something so hard for many, many years and grow just as an obligation? If you don't like it, it's going to be an obligation, right? So you're not going to grow because you're going to start doing the minimum, the absolute minimum just to keep your job, right? That's how people are. But if you like it, and if I give you the tools, and if I give you the freedom, and if I give you whatever training, whatever, we have a lot of research and development. We try so many projects. Sometimes we start with an idea. We work on it for a year. We have like three developers working on it, and then we have to scratch it. But we create another idea. So we use what we, like 80% of what we build for another project, we can get, now all of a sudden another door opens, right? Oh, wow. We can apply what we build to this other, right? So that's real research and development. You don't have like a clear goal. You see, you try, you experiment. And I think you need that in a company. You need to experiment. You need to fail. Otherwise, people are going to start taking it easy. Every day is the same. Right. It becomes boring. Even if you're good at it, you feel like you're struck. And these people are going to leave. The successful people, the great people, they're going to leave if they feel, you know, that's also what I did, right? So I lived through that. I was an employee. So I remember very clearly, you know, how I felt. So I give incentives, right, to have people to grow. Financial incentives, you know, career incentives, and it works. It works really well. Yeah. And we have we offices, but we have a lot of remote people as well. It works. I don't check hours. I don't record the screen. I don't micromanage them, but I hire the right people and I give them the right incentives, and they, you know, just let them figure it out. They will figure it out.
And you see, that's actually, honestly, that's the way I approach my businesses. Every time. And what's interesting is in doing research about you, or on you, I should say, one of the things occasionally that you run across is David can be very demanding. He's a very demanding leader. He's a very demanding person. Now, again, by itself, that's neither negative or positive, right? Because, I'm sure you love your parents, and all our parents can and should be demanding, right? They want the best for us. They want to see us grow because, for my son, I want him to become a good man. I want him to become a good adult. I have to expect, I have to be demanding of him. So demanding in itself isn't bad. Demanding without logic and sensitivity becomes bad, right? So I hear what you said. We're going to look for people who love what they do. We're going to look for people that are willing to learn. We're going to love to hire people. We're going to support them. I heard you say, I'm going to give them the training. I'm going to give them goals.
Yes, give them freedom.
We give them freedom, right.
Yes.
And to me, that's demanding, but it's also allowing someone to grow. And at the same time, you're saying, hey, look, no hard feelings. Not every job is for every person. We tried it for 6 months. We tried it for a year. I don't think we're growing at the pace we want to grow. We gave you opportunities. And this is what happened, you know.
That's what I don't like. Yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to let people go, and that's what I don't like about my job, because these people, you know.
Right.
But usually, when you get there with me, it's because either it's dishonesty, so you know I catch somebody doing something dishonest or lying to me on something big. Of course, you know I have no choice. I can't keep dishonest person. But other times, you know, there were warnings before. I always feel like I did everything I could to help this person. I did everything. I even sometimes tried to change roles. So it's not like a ruthless, you know, oh, you don't bring me, you know, Soros used to have his investment fund. You bring me 6% at the end of the year or you're fired. Very simple. Then you go and this, you know, we're going to talk in 6 months. That's how we do it. But yeah, I like that, but it's not good for me. Okay, I don't feel comfortable doing it, and I think we cannot still achieve great results without having this kind of pressure, right? This immense pressure on people, and we can still be friendly and respect each other, but you know you have to bring results at the end of the month. You know, I want to see, you know, and we measure. Basically, the trick is we measure and we set incentives. So, for example, support people. I have 3, you know, technical support people for my clients, and they have, you know, a little, the signature, a little message. How would you rate the experience, you know? And they have to keep a certain percentage, right? If it goes, and it's 90% right now, imagine that. But it's not like, oh, if you don't eat this 90%, you get fired. No, I do the opposite. If you achieve this 90%, you're going to get this bonus. So it's more like an incentive. It's not like a threat, right? It's not like the mafia. Oh, you do this, otherwise I'm gonna punish you. You know, that's the mafia talk.
Yeah, you know? Right.
This is more like, let's frame it in a positive way, right? So that people also see it as a grow. Like, okay, I can make it. You know, like if I make it, I'm gonna have those whatever.
Right.
$300 extra dollars at a month or whatever is the bonus. So yeah, that it works. It really works. So we always have 90% like for 4 years now. It's really crazy. Yeah, sometimes 87, but you know.
But that's the sign of a good leader, to be honest with you.
Yes.
You have empathy, but you're strict. You also have goals. You frame them as incentives instead of negatives, instead of punishment.
Yes.
You have it as an incentive. And any psychologist, any behavioralist will tell you the same thing. You get better results pushing for the positive with immediate feedback, as opposed to distant negative results. Meaning, like, if after a year you're not at 90%, you're going to get fired.
Yes.
Better to say, work on this, and at the end of the year, if you hit 90%, we're going to give you your 5% bonus, 10% bonus.
Yes.
You get better people, you get more motivated people, and that's when you get people coming to you and saying, hey, boss, I'm at 88%, but I have this idea that I think if we try it, we might hit 90. What do you think?
Exactly.
Can we do it? And then you'll be like, sure, let me review it, and I'll give you the thumbs up tomorrow, right? So I think you're doing a very intelligent thing. You're approaching your business in a very intelligent way.
I learned through the years, okay? I'm not, you know, I didn't start this way. You know, when I had to manage people, I did everything you can do wrong. And I just learned, that's how I learn. Unfortunately, sometimes I need to get humbled in things, then I learn, okay? But I'm not afraid to try and to, you know, do things that sometimes can be a little bit more, why did you say that? Why did you treat this guy this way? But, you know, maybe I did it once and then I learned, I stopped doing it. I understood that you shouldn't do it or stuff like that. Right. So I try to learn. I learn. So, but I'm not afraid of jumping and just also do something if I feel that's the right thing. Right. With these smaller, you know, smaller decisions, I cannot analyze risk. Right. For every decision. Every day I have to make many, many decisions. So I analyze risks. For certain kind of decisions, big decisions that are hard to reverse, that's why you need the most thinking and analysis and learning and being objective and rational. But smaller decisions, day to day, you don't have time, right, to do this. So I don't even allocate it. I take them, boom, like on the fly, because I have my principles, I have my, you know, code in a sense, and I just follow it, And sometimes I update the code. But these, you know, principles, I learned them the hard way, like actually right. with actions, you know, not with theory, with actually practical, like with people and managing people right. and having difficult conversations sometimes and having dishonest people in front of you, people who try to steal from you, people who try to do, they're working two jobs that they don't tell you, right? And they do this parallel. You have all kinds of people, unfortunately, right? So I have to deal with these things. I hired probably over 100 people over the years for different things. So I had my share of bad, you know, things. So one thing I learned also for the company as a group is that you need these shared goals and you need shared incentives, right?
Yes.
So if one team, a sales team, is only cares about, you know, bringing as many clients as possible, but your goal as a company is to provide, you know, to have clients who stick for a long time and take your product seriously and they do it seriously, then you have a complete mismatch of intentions and goals, right?
Right?
So what I learned that you need like you to unify, right? The goals for all every team. So if the strategy for the company is we're gonna have the best customer service in our industry, then everything has to be aligned, you know, to that, you know, to achieve that goal. I cannot have the support people, you know, trying to game the system or doing what's best for them. So I need to align all the processes and the incentives to this goal, right? So it starts, you know, from a decision, a strategic decision, and then it gets like to the concrete level right. of detail, like 98%, but it has to be consistent. And I've seen companies, especially, you know, 200 people companies, 300 people companies, they have these, all these teams basically, and each team has this as its own agenda, has its own, right. you know, ways of thinking about the product and what is good, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. And that creates a lot of inefficiency in a company because you don't have like an army marching, you know, towards the same place. You have one part of the army is marching right. left, one other part is marching right.
right.
So how can you win the war like this, right? So you have to, you know, organize things in a certain way and it works. Most people are honest. Most people are serious. Most people appreciate my style. So but sometimes you have bad apples, but most people, they love it. And I never had one person leaving the company in 4 years, 5 years. I can't believe it, right? Maybe we're treating them too well. but nobody has ever left on their own. Nobody has come to me, oh, I'm going to want to leave. You know, other experiences that I have had, I don't want to make names or stuff, references, people were leaving like all the time, right? The pressure was too high and the pay wasn't, you know, whatever, right? So you need to treat people well, and most people, they will give you back. They will give a lot back to you.
Please, I learned,
believe in that.
Yeah, I do too, because I have to tell you personally, when I first started, I think I mentioned to you before we started recording, I started out in FX. That was my first job on Wall Street, was in the currency markets. And this was right before the Japanese bank failures in the late 80s. And unfortunately, yours truly had the job of creating risk algorithms against Japanese counterparties. It's been almost 40 years. To this day, I can't sleep. Yeah, I can't sleep more than 3 hours a night.
Ooh.
Because back then, that was the demand of the job. I got paid very well. I'm not complaining. I got paid very well. Yeah. My bonuses were very good. They made sure my expense account got me into any restaurant in New York at any time. You know, they treated me very well.
Wow.
And if you know me, I like to eat, you know, so I was a regular Bobby Flay's restaurant, right? But my point being, we would work 24, 48 hours sometimes without sleep. They rolled beds into our offices, little duvets into our offices.
Oh, my God.
Work until you pass out. Then when you wake up, you get back to work. You need coffee.
Whoa.
You need whatever
That's
you need.
Too much.
You let us know. Right. But I was young. I was in my 20s. I said, this is when I do this thing. I witnessed people passing out in the middle of coding. And when they woke up, they were escorted. They were fired. They were out of the
building. No way. Oh my God!
That's how
like
bad
abuse.
It was.
That sounds like slavery to me almost.
Right.
Oh my God.
But I'm not mentioning the name of the company. By the way, it doesn't exist anymore, probably for that reason, among others. But it was the type of demand that you had. That was the, you know, like if anyone saw The Wolf of Wall Street, that was right before that era. So it was crazy. People were doing all sorts of crazy things to get up on top, earn that extra 5, 10, 12% return on top of your what the rest of the street was doing. So I saw that after 4 or 5 years, I got out. I said, if I stay here, I'm going to die, right? So I learned what I learned. Then I moved to a different sort of investment banking arena. And that was much more, again, I wasn't sleeping much, so that gave me a leg up because now my body changed. Like I said, 40 years, I can't sleep more than 3-4 hours a night. I wake up automatically.
Wow.
And the reason for that, for people that don't know, is if you work in FX, there's no such thing as a day off or 9 to 5, right? Because when Japan is trading, New York is sleeping. When London is waking up, New York is shutting down, right? So there's a 24-hour clock, as you know, in the currency markets. This was way before standardized automation. We still had to call people, you know. Before cell phones, we had pagers, you know. So my wife would learn if I passed out at 3 in the morning. My wife learned from the pager. She would call up and start answering. Is this a severity one? Because I'm not waking them up unless it's a severity one. So, you know, but I think business has evolved since then. Because back then it was like, how do we make the most money in the shortest amount of time, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's the same sort of greed. But they understand, like what you said, let's have some goals. Let's treat people, you know, let's not lose our souls while we try to make money, right? And I see that in you. And just from the way you talk, I can appreciate that you kind of have this understanding about business, and that's why you're successful. You know, that's why your company is successful. And I wish you more luck with that. And it's not luck for someone like you, right? Because I think you make your own luck. It's obvious to me, just in this little brief time that we've talked, that you do have this outlook on life that I can appreciate. It's one of the reasons I wanted to interview you, to understand what you're saying. Before we get to the next part of to end up, tell me, like, maybe give me the 5-minute version of your company so people know the work you do. You know, what is it your company does? How can they find more information about Galileo FX or David Matarazzi if they wanted to?
Yeah, so the product that we sell, we have other products coming, but the main product is Galileo FX, which is an automated trading software for independent investors, you know, even beginners, hobby investors or hobby traders, sometimes even professionals. We have also a couple of big clients in Tokyo and in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, right? But most of it, we have this product for you know, people who also want to start or just starting out. And the product, basically, it's a software that buys and sells automatically, which, you know, sounds very familiar to you, but for the retail industry, it's just exploding right now. Before, it wasn't really like that popular. I remember when I was working inside the investment fund in Canada, like I was seeing algorithms all the time, dark pools, you know, people using these algorithms. You know, we have 20, 30, 40 engineers working on this. So I saw like the merits of the technology, right? Of automating when you buy and when you sell. But when I looked at the retail world outside, you know, our bubble.
Institutions. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. The best you could find was like these get rich quick schemes with affiliates, you know, and you download this $99 software and you're gonna, you know, leave your job and you're gonna become a millionaire. You're gonna live in this tropical island and drinking, I don't know what. But you know, it was like almost funny. People are buying this. I was saying people believing this, like they can download like a software and make money automatically. So that's because there was a lot of ignorance, and actually, you know, the algos were kept a little, it's not conspiracy, but normal people and average people didn't have access to this kind of software, right? So I started from a very simple fact, right? Because this was way before AI, this was way before COVID, you know, it was like we started 2019, like, so it was before that, you know, huge
lockdown,
you know, explosion of retail trading and meme stocks that happened, you know, during much later. We caught it in the beginning, but we started earlier. So why did I have this intuition, which is, so looks now like in hindsight, you know, oh, this guy was a genius. No, I started from a very simple fact, right? Manual trading, we had a lot of manual traders doing it. You know, this was also proprietary trading that we were doing. So day traders also making 100 trades a day, keeping a stock, you know, 100 stocks of Apple for 30 seconds and then selling it, right? And they had all these commissions and you get money back from the exchange, all these economics, you know, right, where you can actually limit losses because you get some of the money back because you're creating some volume and liquidity in the market. So they had all these kind of, and but they were sitting on the computer like 8 hours a day. They had to do it manually, right? So I right. saw that it was like a very, you know, time intensive activity and job. They were coming to work 6 a.m., right? So these people were waking up 4 or 5, like very similar to what you were doing, right?
Yeah.
And I said, there's no way like that, you know, people who have a regular job and they want to start trading because maybe they like, you know, following financial markets, they don't have this time. They cannot learn, you know, this, you know, very sophisticated right. manual trading. So one thing is that I always knew is people want convenience. People, we humans, is we are lazy in a sense, but it's a good kind of lazy, right? Because, you know, thanks to this laziness, in a sense, we have cars and we have planes and we right. want to get faster, right. even faster planes. So that's a good thing. It drives a lot of innovation. Like in my case, yeah. so I said, people, you know, eventually they're going to figure out that automated trading is so much better than manual trading, right? You can, you know, replace like 60% of what you do as a manual trader with automation, right? And you keep the 40% to think, right? And to make decisions and to, instead of watching charts and clicking and, you know, using your, with keystrokes and using your keyboard right. to make plays, that a software can do that. You know, these days, there are even software applications that can use eye recognition and like they can recognize patterns on charts. Like a human would. We had people like studying these shapes, right, you know, all right, these shapes. Right. Yeah. And, you know, and then, oh, I need to buy here. I need to sell there. Like technical analysis, like right, but in right, real time, data, that's what we, you know, we were doing.
Right.
So I said, there's no way like a normal person, like, you know, can do this. And I see an empty, you know, space in the market because you have this fake algos, basically, these, I don't want to say scams, but this get rich quick, you know, magical right. software. But you don't have like a credible option for people who want to start with a system, right? Because even just sticking to a system, it's going to improve your results as an investor, as a trader, like dramatically, especially if you're starting. I see the biggest reason why people lose money in the beginning is because they're just jumping from one strategy to the other, from one indicator to the other, from an asset to the other. Oh, today Tesla is trending, I should trade Tesla. No, because when you see Tesla on CNBC, a movement,
too late.
It's too late. It's
too late. Already,
oof,
too late.
Yeah, yeah. Now they have AIs like in the milliseconds after, you know, something is publicly available, and they already have the algo set up. You know, the algo set up that if this happens, this is what you're going to do. If this happens, this other algo is going to do that. So, and with AI, they don't even need the human anymore to check the content. So how can you compete with that? You can't, right? So having a system in the beginning, even if it's not the best system or you don't know how to use it completely, just the fact of the consistency, right? It's going to make it easier because you are more limited, and that, you know, for a beginner, is actually
it's
better.
Good.
Like that, yes. It's good. You don't. You can't leave somebody like lose. Like, oh yeah, do you know? Try this and try that. This person's gonna
give up. Right. For people who are wondering, like something as simple as dollar cost averaging into an index fund. For most individual investors, over the long haul, that's going to be a winning strategy.
Exactly.
If you're a typical investor, you don't have to jump in and
exactly.
out. It takes a little bit of maintenance, a little bit of discipline, and that's it. And when you say system,
yes, exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
That's
a very simple system, but it works. It still yeah. works. You know, Warren Buffett, he made a bet a few years ago, and he bet $1 million that, you know, buying these SP 500 indexes over 10 years is going to beat any hedge fund on Wall Street. And he won because yes. he made 7%, 7.something%. The average hedge fund made 2.6%, right? So, right. you know, right. why, you know, so even a simple system can be very elegant, right? It can be very, right. like, elegant, and you just stick to the system. But most people, right. they struggle to stick to a system. That's really what's, you know, making it really hard for them. But they don't see it, of course, because they are new, right? They're new to trading and investing, so they don't really see things as they are, and they think, oh, if I try enough, you know, methods, eventually I'm going to stumble in the winning method. No, you know, you pick a method, and you make it work, you know, and you stick to it. You actually have to do things, right? It's not that it's going to do things by itself. You still have, you know, even the dollar cost averaging, you actually have to do it and to stick right. to it. And right. that's actually right. the hardest thing in trading and investing. Like, it's a lot of psychology. Right. So we give a system, you have the system, and you can customize it, right? Because we don't want to have a black box that people don't know what, you know, what is going on. Why is it buying? Why is it selling? Maybe it's going to be good for somebody because they have high risk, or maybe not. So I said, there are different people in this world, right? Some people are more comfortable with high risk, high reward type of situations and strategies. Some people are more conservative, and they really, you know, maybe they worked really hard for that money, or maybe they don't like losses. They take it personally, makes their life miserable. Why would you use like a high risk, high reward strategy, even if it makes money for you? It's going to make you like a miserable person. So based on your personality, right. right, you should be able to customize like the system and to point right. the system in a certain direction, right? Right. And then you can choose the asset you want to trade. So we give total freedom, and you can, you know, you can customize it and just let it go. And then you can measure results. You can try like 20 different strategies. Automated, and you go about for your day, you know, you go to work or whatever, the software is going to buy and sell, you come back home at night, and you check the results. Okay, this strategy worked today, this strategy didn't work, this strategy worked not so well, and you get rid of the non-working strategies, you keep maybe one or two out of 20 that worked. So it's a lot of, you know, actually, you know, you pointing the machine to a certain direction, and you managing right. the machine. But you're not doing the actual work of buying and selling.
Right. But so if I understand, like, for example, with this software, like if I said to it, go find me arbitrage opportunities with dollar counterparties, right? Is that something your software would do? Or is your software more I want a dollar cost average into the S&P 500, and every time there's a 10% gain, sell half of it and put it into a bond fund, right? So that might be my strategy. I'm 60 years old. I'm nearing yes. retirement. That's what I want to do. Your software yes. will do that.
So that what you say total sense. That's more like an investment strategy. Remember, here we're talking more about trading. So you are buying and selling all the time. Like maybe you do even 50 trades a day. It's more like a high frequency in a sense. So the way the software runs is that you load it up on a chart. You choose an asset. Let's say you choose Apple, gold, Euro, USD, whatever you want to trade. Right. Whatever your broker gives you access to, because you need a broker, right? We're not like a financial institution. So you need a broker, and you load up the software, and the software is going to analyze basically in real time what's going on, right? Mm. And we have our own algo, right? Which is secret, of course, but you can like tailor and measure, right? So you can point the algo to a certain, you know, direction so that it takes fewer like risky trades, for example, or more risky trades. You can customize it much more than this, okay? But I'm just giving you like, so basically the software is analyzing what's going on every millisecond on the market, what's actually happening on the chart, right? What is happening on the book, on the order book, what's going on?
I see.
And then it's going to place decisions based on what, you know, patterns that he sees. Okay, so this is a lot of pattern trading, and it works, right? It works if you know how to do it, if you like it, it's gonna work, it's gonna be what's more fun. But I would never advise anybody to put their, you know, savings or retirement. Here we're talking about, you know, somebody who likes to follow the markets, and they like to, they maybe the financial news junkies, and they have their own ideas, thoughts about money, they have a couple of grand sitting there. You know, they want to, it's more about, you know, the winning. It's more in a sense like a game, right? We don't sell to people who have this, you know, ambition of becoming professional traders. Some of them, they do. Some of them, they started with us, and now they're working on Wall Street, right? But that's not the usual path. Most of the people, they just enjoy it, right? It's fun, right? It's, you can see if you were right, if you were wrong, right? Now, today, you know, we have the Trump-Putin meeting in Alaska, right?
Yeah.
Markets are going to react to that. You're going to see it in the market. Right. So you're going to see some stocks doing better or worse depending on the outcome of the meeting. You're going to see some currencies that will be doing better or worse based. So you can, you know, you can use this, you know, information to place these trades, and it's going to be a lot of fun, right? And some people, they take it to the extreme level. Some people, you know, they of course, we have 15,000 clients. So you have all kinds of people, 15,000, over the years. Yeah. And it's all self-financed, right? We have no investor. Imagine that. So
I know that's
everything back to the business.
That's impressive. It's a still a private-owned business. And,
yes.
100%
I own it.
Yeah, and that's fantastic to see. Very quickly, is there a website or somewhere people can go to learn about you?
Yeah, galileofx.com. You know, you go there. We have a 24/7 team on chat if you prefer to chat. If you want to meet like a video call, we can do that. We have a team in the U.S. I have six people in the U.S. You know, we cover all the working hours, so you don't need to wake up early to connect with somebody in Europe or stuff like that. We had, you know, the reason I'm mentioning, because we had that problem before, right? That people were booking at 4 a.m. in California to talk to us. Like, well, we can't keep going. Like, we have to find somebody in North America, you know, because I want to offer, you know, I want that 90%, you know, I want that 90%. So let's do it. And it works. And so we can talk to us. And
I was going to say, folks, if you're going to go to a company, go to a company that strives for 90% customer satisfaction, like David said, because then they'll work hard to earn your trust and earn your business. Okay, David, it's been a fascinating talk, but very rapid fire now. We're going to do something called silly questions. And this is where I'm just going to ask you five questions. There's no right or wrong answer. This is where you tell me the first thing that comes to your mind and tell me why. We'll see if we could have some fun with this. Question number one, what's your favorite food if you can't have Italian food? What is your favorite food?
Oh, American hamburgers. In New York, I know a few places. I know a few places. Wow, amazing. With cheddar, you know, and onions, grilled onions. And I like to have two type of onions, like grilled onions and raw onions on the same burger. And try it. It's pretty good. You have a, like a deeper flavor of onions.
Yeah.
And I love it. I really love it. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Question number two. What is your favorite type of music that you listen to?
Well, of course, rock and roll music. I have it tattooed on my, you know, on my wrist. This is another of those decisions that I made, you know, when I was young.
Younger,
I didn't regret it because I said, if I, you know, because my parents would say, oh, you're never going to find a job if you have this. I said, you know, but I don't want to work for a company that just, you know, they're not going to hire me because of this. So we're going to be fine. You know, I'm not, I don't, you know, it's not going to work anyway. So fine. But yeah. Rock and roll.
What's your favorite band? Or
favorite band? Probably right. It changes right now. The Ramones, I think. New York punk rock.
Hey, you're talking to Mr. Ramone here. Saw them live in 1978. In 1978 at CBGB's. If you could see the wall behind me.
No way.
I still have the autographed Marky Ramone autographed a couple of albums. Actual vinyl.
Wow. Wow.
Actually got to sit with him for an hour when I was still doing my radio show at Sirius XM. He came into my studio, talked to him for an hour.
Marky Ramone, drummer.
The drummer, yeah. Not the original, not Tommy.
And now I'm going to say something to you. You won't believe it. You know, Marky Ramone, this is the same person. He's living 20 minutes from me in Italy. He moved to Tuscany.
You can check
it out. He left New York in the U.S. Now he lives 20 minutes from me.
Do you want to know something funnier? His father, this is what he told me, his father was a sous chef at I'm not 100% if it was the Ritz-Carlton in New York. And at one point, he started selling his own spaghetti sauce.
Oh, wow.
And he donates
so
all
probably,
the profits.
So probably, the food played a role for him to move here. Because sometimes I think, wow, this guy was born in New York. Like, he lived in the city. He had the best time in his life.
He was
why move here? It's not, born, it's just a bunch of old people.
He was born in the place that's probably the least similar to Italy, to any village in Italy. He was born in Queens, New York. Yeah, so it's crazy. Man. But yeah, okay, so here, there you go. We found something else that we share in common, the remote.
Yes.
Fair enough. Okay, if you could pick one philosopher or economist that you would tell somebody, you got to learn from this guy, you got to learn economics from this guy, who would that person be?
Today, and so there are many from the past, okay, but people usually, you know, the past, they look aged, even the videos, and they talk in a certain way. It's too, you know, it's not that fun. Right now, Peter Schiff, I think he gets it right all the time, most of the time. He predicted the great financial crisis, even on TV. They have clips. Mm-hmm. calling out the real estate bubble. And he got it right with inflation. When the Fed was saying, "Oh, it's not going, we're not going to have inflation," he got it right. He has the. I was listening to his podcast, right? I listened to him every day, basically. He was saying it, because, but he was not the only one, of course. But he's one of those people on Wall Street that he actually takes the time to record like a one-hour podcast and just, you know, give commentary. And he's like a strong libertarian. His father, Irwin Schiff, he went to jail actually, right? For his, you know, because he wrote a book about the federal mafia. So that's, you know, I appreciate. Yeah, of course he likes gold, but he's a little biased. He's biased, yes. But I like to listen also to smart people who have a different opinion from me, and maybe I can learn something. I can steal their point of view. I can still see their point of view without agreeing with them, right? I can. I like to listen to smart people in general, right? So I don't need an echo chamber. I don't need yes men in life. Right? So Peter Schiff, guys, check him out. Because he gets it right. I don't know how he does it, but he gets it right most of the time about big, you know, big financial and economic issues.
Yeah, I like Peter Schiff a lot. As you did, as you mentioned, he is a bit of a libertarian. I actually, more than his financial advice, I find his economic views just to be more spot on. Like, I think there's a lot of people, like you said, he's a gold bull. So, you know, a lot of people don't.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about financial advice. Sorry, I was talking more about
economics.
Like, yes, of course, economics and what's going on. You need to understand what's really going on sometimes also to trade and to invest, right? You need to have an understanding of, you know, things.
Peter Schiff's a good modern day economist to look at. Last question. You're on your television or you're surfing on your computer, which however you consume. What's the one movie, if you see it, you say, I got to watch it to the end? No matter where it starts, you see this movie, you got to watch it to the end. What movie is that?
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Sergio Leone.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yes. I've watched it like probably 100 times. And it's like a metaphor for life. It's not just one of those Western movies. Actually, he changed the Western movie, you know, dogmas. Because he had like this raw and more like cynical. You know, he made people really like how they really are in life. Not like in America, at the time, I'm not an expert in movies, okay? But the way I understand it, at the time, like movies were like you had the good guy and the bad guy. It was, you know, always the same.
Very black and white.
Storytelling. But reality is different. You know, we are not always good people. We're not always bad people, right? And most people, they oscillate a little bit. You have the extremes, yes. But that's like, you know, I love The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Yes, that's my favorite movie.
That's a great flick. And actually, just ended on this. I think the cowboy culture that got exported out of the United States, when you talk to people who were raised outside the United States, even someone as young as yourself, you still find that image of the American cowboy, like either for good or bad, still resonates with people. I think being born in the U.S., you really don't get it. Yeah, we had the Western, we had the Cowboys, the John Waynes, the Clint Eastwoods, and you say to yourself, yeah, that was part of our thing. But when you go to Japan, for example, very big on cowboy culture, parts of Europe, very big on cowboy.
Yeah, we had a festival in Italy, people dressing as cowboys. What? You know, I haven't seen this in Texas, I see it in Italy. Right, yeah, but I think it's part of, you know, the movies. People who cannot travel, they learn about America from the movies and from TV and from music. So maybe they fantasize a little too much sometimes, right?
Right, but it's an image that's certainly still strong. All right, David Matarazzi, thank you so much for joining us here on The Big Questions. It was a pleasure talking to you. Everyone, please go check out Galileo FX, galileofx.com. Hook up with David's customer service, 90% plus rating for 5 years. Check them out. Certainly, David, thank you for joining me. And everyone out there, follow us right here on Grumblings Media. Every episode of The Big Questions, someone very interesting and intelligent for us to talk to. Hopefully, we can learn as much from them as we learned from David today. Until next time, that has been John. Peace, everyone.